ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय नरायणं नमस्कृत्य नरं चैव नरोत्तमं देवीं सरस्वतीं व्यासं ततो जयमुदीरये नाष्टप्रयेषु भद्रेषु नित्यं भगवत्सेवया भगवद्गीतमश्लोकी भक्तिर्भवति नैष्ठिकी. So today we are reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam. This is the 9th canto, chapter 4, entitled Maharaj Ambarish Maharaj offended by Durvasa Muni, and this is verse number 28. Please repeat. Tasmai adat hari chakram pratyanika vaya avaham ekanta bhakti bhavena pritaha bhakta abhirakshanam smadadarishchakram pratyanika bayavam ekanta bhakti bhavena ritra bhakta abhirakshanam. Please repeat. Tasmai unto him, Ambarish Maharaj, Adat gave Hari, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Chakram, his disc, Pratyanika Bhaya Avaham, the Lord's disc, which was extremely fearful to the enemies of the Lord and his devotees. Ekanta bhakti bhavena, because of his performing unalloyed devotional service. Prittaha, the Lord being so pleased. Bhakta abhirakshanam, for the protection of his devotees. Translation and prepared by his divine grace, Srila Prabhupada. Being very pleased by the unalloyed devotion of Maharaj Ambarish, the Supreme Personality of Godhead gave the king his disc, which is fearful to enemies and which always protects the devotees from enemies and adversities. Please repeat. Being very pleased by the unalloyed devotion of Maharaj Ambarish, the Supreme Personality of Godhead gave the king his disc, which is fearful to enemies and which always protects the devotees from enemies and adversities. Purport. A devotee being always engaged in the service of the Lord may not be expert in self-defense, but because a devotee fully depends on the lotus feet of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, he is always sure of protection by the Lord. Prahlad Maharaj said, Nevod vijay para duyalatya yavaitaran yas tvadvir yagayana mahamlita magna chittaha. Bhagavatam 7.9.43. A devotee is always merged in the ocean of transcendental bliss of rendering service to the Lord. Therefore, he is not at all afraid of any adverse situation in the material world. The Lord also promises, Kunteya pratijanihi name bhakta pranashyati. O Arjuna, you may declare to the world that the devotees of the Lord are never vanquished. Bhagavad Gita 9.31. For the protection of the devotees, Krishna's disc, the Sudarshan Chakra, is always ready. This disc is extremely fearful to the non-devotees. Pratyanika bayavaham. Therefore, although Maharaj Ambarish was fully engaged in devotional service, his kingdom was free of all fear of adversity. Omagyana timiranda siya genanjana shalakaya chakshurum militam yena tasmai shri gurave namaha vancha kalpatrubhyasya kripasinubhye vacha patitanam pavanebhyo vaishnavibhyo namo namaha. So, this is a very wonderful pastime which occurred here in Vrindavan. And as the chapter unfolds, it was a Maharaj Ambarish who has performed a very vrata. He was performing an Ekadishi vrata, he and his wife, for a year. And after a year, he was fasting for 3 days. And then he arranged for a big feast to celebrate the end of the vrata. And he was supposed to break that fast on a very particular moment, the last muhurta of that Dvadishi remained, and at that time he was supposed to break the fast. However, Durvasa Muni appeared as a guest, unexpected, apparently uninvited, and the king received him with great respect. So, and offered him to take prasadam. So Durvasa Muni said, yes, but first I have to go to the Yamuna and bath, and then I'll come and take prasadam. But the king had to break his vow, break the Ekadishi. It was very the last muhurta of that Dvadishi, and he was supposed to break the fast. But he didn't want to offend his guest by eating before him. So he consulted the Brahmins and he said, what should I do in this circumstance? He wasn't acting whimsically, he was very thoughtful and considering what he should do. And the answer was, you should drink a little water and that will not be considered eating, but it would be considered breaking the fast. So he acted upon that and he did that and drank a little water. And then Durvasa Muni came. And he was furious. He was very angry. How did you eat before me? How dare you? So then he had his power, his siddhis, he was a yogi. And he took a hair and he created a demon to kill Ambarish. But the Supreme Lord with the chakra appeared and chased the demon, killed the demon, and started chasing Durvasa Muni, who ran away. I won't tell the end of the story. This is forthcoming. You have many classes on the way. So let's leave it there. But and it all happened here in Vrindavan. So that is a paradigmatic story in various ways. First of all, Maharaj Ambarish himself, as a devotee, is paradigmatic. He's very famous for his execution and devotional service. And with your permission, I'd like to read a few verses back, which you read. I know you know them all, but just for my own purification, let me just repeat, because these are very famous verses and very important. Just read the first Sanskrit. Savai mana Krishna padaravinda yor vacham shivai kunta gunanu varnane karoharer mandira marajana dishu shutim chakaratshu tasat Katodaye. Maharaj Ambarish always engages his mind in meditating upon the lotus feet of the Lord, his words in describing the glories of the Lord, his hands in cleansing the Lord's temple, and his ears in hearing the words spoken by Krishna or about Krishna. He engaged his eyes in seeing the deity of Krishna, Krishna's temples, and Krishna's place like Mathura and Vrindavan. He engages his sense of touch in touching the bodies of the Lord's devotees. He engages his sense of smell in smelling the fragrance of Tulasi offered to the Lord, and he engages his tongue in tasting the Lord's prasad. He engages his legs in walking to the holy places and temples of the Lord, his head in bowing down before the Lord, and all his desires in serving the Lord, 24 hours a day. Indeed, Maharaj Ambarish never desired anything for his own sense gratification. He engaged all his senses in devotional service, in various engagements related to the Lord. This is the way to increase attachment for the Lord and to be completely free from all material desires. So that is These are very famous verses, and Maharaj Ambarish is paradigmatic as an exemplary devotee who was fully engaged 24 hours with all his thoughts, mind and deeds on all directions. And as I mentioned, that is very exemplary. But there's also something other which is interesting here and exemplary here, and that is this encounter between the yogi and the devotee. A very interesting encounter between two spiritualists, and that requires, I would say, some thought and some glimpse into what is yoga, what is devotion, what are the borders of yoga, what is devotional yoga, and where are we in all that? In which side are we? Are we yogis? Are we devotees? Are we both? What are we exactly? So we can perhaps say that the classical yoga system, one of the two schools, yoga and Sankhya, has the Ashtanga, the eight limbs ladder, as its core. And that ladder is, of course, composed of yama and then niyama, asana, pranayama, pratyahara, dharana, dhyana, samadhi. That is the classical yoga system. It is structured like a ladder. One stage leads to another. Although one may practice all the stages simultaneously, one building upon the other. Just like in school, one goes to first grade, he or she learns something, but when they are sent to the second grade, they still practice that. They don't forget that. They still practice that, and their knowledge expands. So that is the classical system. We may also break it down, because it also has to do with us, to the first five limbs of yama, which are ahimsa, non-violence, satya, truth, asteya, non-stealing, brahmacharya, renunciation, and aparigraha, non-accumulating. And then, of course, we have niyama, and that is shocha, cleanliness, purity, santosha, satisfaction, tapas, austerity, svadhyaya, learning scriptures, self-study, and Ishvara Paridhanam, which is, if you like, the theistic component of surrender to God, which is also there in the yoga system, although it is not as developed as in the bhakti tradition. In the bhakti tradition, you have a very sophisticated theology. We are here, we are in the Gaudiya Vaishnava tradition, we have Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. So sophisticated, so developed ideas of the Supreme, the personhood, various manifestations of the various moods, rasas, ways of devotion. In the yoga tradition, that is not developed, but it exists. But we can say that the focus of the yoga system is slightly different. The yoga system, in a sense, is neutral theologically. It is based upon mental restraint. The main practice or the main limb is the mind. The mind is the main limb. And we are also yogis, we are bhakti yogis, and we have to see in what way we are bhakti yogis and where is our yoga and how our yoga is different from Ashtanga yoga. So the idea is, and Srila Prabhupada writes about this extensively in various places, but especially the sixth chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. He writes about the process of yoga. And yoga is used in various senses around the Gita. Let us stay for now with the basic sense of the yoga school, but we have to acknowledge that yoga is used in various ways in the Bhagavad Gita, even sometimes as mysticism, even the concluding verse of the Bhagavad Gita, Yatra Yogeshvara Krishna. Krishna is Yogeshvar, the master, Prabhupada said, all mystics. But let us come to that. So, the mind is the core practice of yoga, and as both chapter 6 and Srila Prabhupada comments, the mind can be one's best friend, and it can also be one's worst enemy. And Srila Prabhupada talks about this quite a bit in the sixth chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. One who has failed to control her mind will drag them down. One who is able to control the mind, then that person will go up. Udare Datmanatmanam. One should elevate oneself by his own mind and not degrade himself. Okay. So we have to see where the mind is situated. And the mind, in a sense, is situated between the senses and the self. It's in between. It serves to regulate the senses. The mind governs the senses, controls the senses, and also regulates them or diverts them. For example, right now we are hearing, so we're perhaps focusing on our hearing capacity and not on our tasting or not on our smelling sense. So that's the mind. We have the famous chariot proverb, which is the pictures there in Bhagavad Gita as it is, of the mind and the senses. The source is the Katha Upanishad. That's where this tale comes from. And that speaks of a chariot with horses. And there's two stages according to which that chariot rides. The materialistic state or state is that the passenger who represents the Atman, the soul, is unconscious. The horses, which represent the five senses, are roaming, are uncontrolled. The reins, which represent the mind, are free. The buddhi, the intelligence, which is the charioteer, loses control, and this is a very dangerous situation, of course, and the chariot is about to fall down from the cliff or something. It's a horrible situation. But then there is sometimes a moment where the rider, the passenger, wakes up, and says, "Stop! Stop it!" And he calls the charioteer to order. "You control the horses. Take control of the horses." And the charioteer controls the reins and controls the horses and leads them to the right path. That moment is very mystical to my mind. That moment of awakening. Some people may live, and it doesn't occur to them that anything is wrong. Everything is great. What's wrong? They don't have this awakening. They don't have this moment of looking at the situation and asking, "What am I doing here? Where am I going? That's my life. Is that the way I want to use to spend my life? Am I not under the jurisdiction of the gunas? Where am I in all that? Apparently, most people, they don't ask this question, and only a rare souls actually wake up to that reality and ask the question. How does the third verse of the seventh chapter goes? Manushyanam saha shishu kachid yatati siddhaye yatatam apisiddhanam kashimim vehitatvatadat. Out of many thousands among men, one may endeavor for perfection, and even among them, there's hardly one who knows Krishna in person. So that is a rare thing, that awakening and that ability to open one's mind and heart and look around and see, where am I going, what is happening, and how can I take control of the senses. So basically, get it short, at a certain moment the yogi, he or she, the also yoginis, struggles with the mind and controls the mind. And it is a struggle. And that is done in various ways, but basically through tapasya, various ways of tapasya. And if we'll have time, Srila Prabhupada writes about it just in the verses, how devotional service is a tapasya. And Srila Prabhupada mentions how deity worship is a yogi tapasya. But let's come to that later. Let's see. So there are two limbs, two components of yoga. And one is abhyasa. Abhyasa is constant practice. Abhyasa yoga yuktena chaitasa nanya gamina paramam purusham divyam yati partan uchintayam. So that's also in the Gita, the term of abhyasa. So that is abhyasa, is constant practice. But there's another component, which is vairagya, which is detachment. Because if one doesn't give up, one can struggle with the mind, but if one continues to hold to the attachments, to the objects, if one does it, then the abhyasa will be very difficult and you won't get far. So you also have to give up. And that is a different mental state. How can one describe this internal state of giving up? Something also, I think, mystical. One person cannot give up. You say, give up. No, I can't. I can't. Give up. No, I can't. I'm trying. Another person just gives up. Again, a mental state, an internal state of a detachment. So, the yoga process, in a sense, as I mentioned before, is neutral from the theological point of view. There are various yogis, various gurus, various proponents of spirituality, who took various limbs of the yoga ladder and emphasized them. Mahatma Gandhi, for example, who's now, it's his 150th anniversary, and Srila Prabhupada was also his follower at the beginning, before he met Srila Bhaktisiddhanta. He constructed a system based upon yama and niyama. He called the system satyagraha. Satya is the second limb, holding the truth. His main component was ahimsa, non-violence. He's very famous for ahimsa. And of course he practiced aparigraha and tapas. And I think that we are close to the Gandhian movement, ISKCON, in that idea of simple living and high thinking. I think that idea is close to the Gandhian ideal. His idea of living in farms, working the land, working physically. We also have that simple living, high thinking ideal of having farms, cows. Not all of us do that. I don't plow the fields, but I cherish the idea. Other spiritualists, for example, if you take B.K.S. Iyengar, who passed away recently, a few years ago, he took the Hatha Yoga as his main practice, spread around the world, basically asana, also pranayama, but basically asana. Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, he took the meditation, the dhyana, he tried to develop that. So the yoga can be deconstructed into various components. But the yoga is neutral. So some yogis, they can be Buddhists. They can have Buddhist ideology, but the yoga will elevate them. And Srila Prabhupada makes a very important, I would say, statement in many places that yoga is actually meant for Paramatma realization. I didn't hear that anywhere else. Only Srila Prabhupada talks about Paramatma, and I think he got something brilliant there. And it's a very deep vision, which again, I don't think any other movement speaks about this idea of Paramatma, a very mystical idea of this theistic idea of God in the heart, and how yoga actually, in its advanced stage, leads to a Paramatma realization. And that's very deep, and that's perhaps the way to interpret mysticism, yoga as mysticism, as a Paramatma realization. But one can also devote one's yoga practice to a devotional service. And that is what we're doing. We are yogis, and we are devotional yogis. And I'll expand upon that. But before that, I still want to remain with Durvasa Muni and ask, why was he angry? He's a spiritualist, a yogi, very advanced. So where is that anger? Why? Why to be angry? I mean, okay, so he couldn't understand the situation. Maharaj Ambarish wanted to break his fast. That was Vedic. It was proper. It was thoughtful. He's consulted the Brahmins. I mean, what's the big thing? And apparently, there was some anger there in his heart. If we read Bhagavad Gita, we see, I mean, let's go the other way around. People say, I'm angry because of this and this and that. You did this, you did that, and that's why I'm angry. But if we read Bhagavad Gita, Dhyayato Vishayan Pumsa Sangas Te Shubhajayate Sangas Sanjayate Kamaha Kamat Krodha Abhijayate. Anger is there from an uncontrolled mind. From Dhyayato Vishayan Pumsa, from contemplating the objects of the senses. That brings attachment, and attachment brings lust, and lust brings anger. That's how it works. And then we get lust, kama esha, krodha esha, raja guna samudava mahashana mahapamam vidya nam iha vairinam, that this is the all-devouring enemy of the world. So apparently being a yogi wasn't enough to cleanse the heart. That's my point. He got very far in his practice, and he got siddhis, he got powers, but he was not able to cleanse the heart. And that is perhaps a difference between this mystical yoga, Ashtanga yoga, and devotional yoga. And I'll return to our Bhakti yoga, but let us now ask this question: How is the heart cleansed? And for this, we of course go back to the Bhagavatam, Srinvatam, Svakata Krishna, Punya Shravana Kirtana, Lidyanta Stoya Badrani, Vidunoti, Surit Satam. Ridi Antrasta. This is the Paramatma. Ridi Antrasta. Situated in the heart. He will return to the Paramatma. But the Paramatma is not only observing, but Krishna is cleansing their heart from within. Krishna is cleansing the heart from within. We have the same idea in the Bhagavad Gita, 10th chapter, that Krishna says, out of compassion, being in their heart, I cleanse their heart. So, the process is we develop taste for hearing the message of the Lord, and that hearing is very deep. What we're doing now, Shravanam, that hearing is very deep. It goes very deep to the heart. It goes beyond the mind, beyond the senses. It goes very deep. But even that on its own is not sufficient, because there Krishna comes and helps. Nashta prayeshu abhadrashu nityam bhagavatam sevaya bhagavat yutamash loke bhakti bhavati nashtiki. Yeah, so that's reading the Bhagavatam destroys the inauspicious things in the heart. So I would say that the devotional practice would go deeper. Yoga will control the mind, will award one with a mental strength, with renunciation, with siddhis, strong powers. But that purification of the heart is unique for bhakti yoga. But don't give up on yoga too quickly. Don't think that we are not yogis, because you are yogis. And I actually underwent a deep change here in Vrindavan, a change of heart, you could say. I came here 28 years ago, and as a student in the VIHE, Vaishnava Institute of Higher Education, that was Gaur Purnim 91. I was registered, and I studied Bhagavad Gita under Burjan Prabhu. It was a great course. All the other courses were good. By Braj Bihari, Dhananda Swami, it was all great. And they would register us if we came late to the Mongol Arati at the Samadhi. You have to write down whether you came on time or came late.
I'm going to start that again.
Good. So now I'm afraid I come a few minutes before because of the VHE training. So Burjan Prabhu, he wrote and spoke much about the yoga ladder. The yoga ladder, that was a major concept which he taught in that. And the yoga ladder is a devotional ladder being grounded in karma yoga and going all the way up to devotional service. And he analyzes the Bhagavad Gita according to that yoga ladder. And the yoga ladder is a ladder which is based upon one's internal motive for performing action. Means I do some action, he does, she does, someone does, and you cannot tell from outside what is my motive, what is motivating me, what is driving me. And the yoga ladder focuses on that motive and says that at first there will be a personal motivation. I do something to gain something, some fruit. Utilitarianism. A higher grade, I think Burjan Prabhu called it dharmic utilitarianism. I do it to go to Svarga, to heaven. I will give charity, but in my eye, I would like to go up to heaven. Then a higher stage will be a stage of acting without a desire for the fruit. Karmani eva adhikaraste ma paleshu kadachana ma karma pala heturbur mate sangastva karmani. Performing one's activities, one's duty, one's dharmic duty, but without attachment to the fruit. Karmani eva adhikaraste, the work itself, the action itself is your adhikara, it belongs to you, your duty. Ma paleshu kadachana, but never not the fruits. Ma karma pala heturbu, don't think yourself that you're the awarder of the fruits. But then don't be inactive, don't go to sleep. Nastve, what's then? Nate sangastva karmani, disassociate yourself from karma, don't be inactive. So then that goes higher, and there are various ways of it's going higher. Acting for the highest good, for Brahman. And then there's a very interesting practice, a very interesting stage of performing one's work or service as yoga. And with your permission, let me see, I think it's the next verse in Prabhupada's purport. If I'll find it, I want to read that. But probably I will not find it. No. Was the last verse. Anyhow, I won't look for this now. But it's here in one of his verses, but I should have prepared it. But as I mentioned before, Prabhupada mentions and describes devotional service as a type of tapas and yoga. And he particularly mentions deity worship. That in deity worship we have to be exact, we have to be punctual, and all that requires discipline, and that is yoga, bhakti yoga. So we are also practicing yoga, and it is an important part of our practice, but it is a devotional yoga. It's not asanas, but it is yoga. And that we have to see that yogic component in our practice. That's, I think, last year we discussed it. That's basically Vedic bhakti, that we are performing regulative bhakti and regulated bhakti, and that is a yogic practice. So then it goes higher, and eventually it goes to underlying devotional service. And if you like, the Gita, as we heard, I think, yesterday's class, goes and continues in the Bhagavatam. The Bhagavatam continues to develop this ladder, and that karma yoga of the Bhagavad Gita turns gradually into devotion, and that dharma turns into bhakti. Save pumsam paro dharmo yato bhakti razoksaje ahaitukya pratyata yatma suprasiddhi. This is Bhagavatam, first canto, second chapter. So, save pumsam paro dharmo, that dharma in the Gita, which is Vanashama dharma, and that develops into a devotional service that in turn develops into bhakti. So we have to see that connection between karma, which gradually turns into bhakti. It's a little late, but there's something I'd like to open the floor for questions, but there is something I'd like to add to that idea of ladder, of a yogic ladder. And I'd like to add that the yogic ladder is an analysis of the Bhagavad Gita. Now, interestingly, not all the acharyas wrote commentaries on the Bhagavad Gita. Lord Chaitanya didn't comment upon the Bhagavad Gita. I have it from academic sources. They say that Advaita Acharya, he had the Gita commentary, which was apparently lost. The Goswamis, they did not did not write on the Bhagavad Gita. You know, we have the works written here, mentioned Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, Vidagdha Madhava, Lita Madhava, Hari Bhakti Vilas, but they did not write works, Gita commentaries. They had great respect for Sridhar Swami, who wrote Bhavarta Bodhini, his Bhagavatam commentary. Sridhar Swami also had the Gita commentary, but they did not refer to that. They emphasized, following Lord Chaitanya, his Bhagavatam commentary. The Vaishnava scholar who wrote, apparently here in Vraj, a commentary on the Gita is Srila Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur. And he was living 17th, 18th century, approximately 1640 to 1730. That was his time. He was Bengali, but he was working here in Vraj. He was writing here. And he wrote his commentary called Sararta Varshini Tika. So that is the source of that idea of the yoga ladder. I consulted Burijan Prabhu. I said, where is it come? He says, you have to look for Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur. So I searched, and apparently that book exists. Bhanu Swami translated and published that book. So I got it from Bhanu Swami. And that is really the source, which I found, of this idea of the yoga ladder. So it's coming from Srila Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur, and he wrote a Gita commentary. Also, Baladev Vidyabhushana apparently had a Gita commentary. But as I mentioned, not all acharyas engaged with the Gita. Srila Prabhupada very openly began his literary project with publishing Bhagavad Gita as it is. So for Prabhupada and for Prabhupada's followers, means for us, the Bhagavad Gita is very important, and it is the foundation which keeps us in line. Anyhow, it's 9 o'clock. I had some other things I want to say, but I guess we have to stop here. So here we go. We stop. And any questions or comments, I think our president, of course, we have to thank him for protecting us and keeping everything together. So let us take this moment and say thank you for your service and for keeping this. It seems that everything is just happening by itself, but we don't think so. We know it's very, if we can dance and chant and have Bhagavan classes, it's because of your service and protection. So thank you.
Jai.
So you have the ladder, you were speaking about, it sounds like disciplines, like military, there's basic training. So we're getting basic training that we learned in VIH years ago. It's stuck with you. And so when the body first comes, the essentials are laid out. And it seems that Srila Prabhupada laid out a very scientific formula so that you can develop these good qualities and have longevity in Krishna consciousness by following. But sometimes there's a tendency of changing things with the times. You know, we think it's a different time now, it's 2019, so, you know, I really don't have to go to this puja or that puja. And matter of fact, maybe it's recent those Swami books and live in the bank of here or there. So what is this tendency for changing if the acharya in a medicinal way is given us the best formula and the best medicine, so we should actually stick to that and not change that?
Well, I'm into education. Unsurprisingly, I'm into education, into studies, into learning, and I think that to gain the stability, we have to gain that by establishing educational institutions like the VHE, like other institutions, and studying our core scriptures is very, very important. We have to be aware of Srila Prabhupada's literary legacy. And basically, Prabhupada gave four books, which I would say would keep ISKCON on track. The first is Bhagavad Gita as it is. Very openly, a Bhagavad Gita, a very good Bhagavad Gita translation and commentary, which keeps the basics. Then, of course, Prabhupada's biggest work with the Srimad Bhagavatam, no doubt, his life work. And then the Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita, which brings in the Chaitanya ethos, a whole different ethos. Feast, dancing, chanting, that it comes to life with the Chaitanya Vaishnava ethos, the whole culture. And then, of course, Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, Nectar of Devotion, and that is the manual for devotional life. What is to be a devotee? That's a very deep and sophisticated book about how to be a devotee. So once we have this as our focus, that's our literary legacy, and study within these borders, I believe will be very, 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 very strong. And even the questions of rasas, which we discussed last year, we will not be affected as long as we have the Gita. We can deal with that. It will not sway us. It will not take us away as long as we have the Gita as our ground, the basic practice. That we can have it in a balanced way, in an enriching way, without taking us swaying apart. So I would say education. Education for all of us, for others, but also for all of us. Let's study. Actually, when I was in that course, Burijan Prabhu wrote me, study the Gita and teach it to others. So I took that as kind of a life instruction. I studied, I got a few academic degrees, and I make my life as teaching the Gita in academic circles. And I have my own edition of the Bhagavad Gita, which is very devotional. But academic, published in various languages, and just a few days ago we got the news from Brazil that it's now accepted by a very good publisher. So I'm studying, I'm teaching, and I'm very happy doing that. I want to do it more. The more I do it, I see more opportunities for writing, for expanding so much things, and all that within the boundaries, which are very, very wide. Prabhupada's boundaries are very, very wide. Yes, Prabhu.
Ishwar Krishna, Prabhu, thank you very, very much for such a wonderful class. It's fair to say we don't get so many such wonderful classes. So thank you very much.
Sure, more.
You said the moment of awakening to my mind is mystical.
Yeah.
So my question is, how can we enhance the awakening of others in terms of, as you described, Vishnu Chakravarti said, the ladder going from yoga to bhakti, is the answer simply education?
No, I wouldn't say education. There is something mystical there, depending upon the soul's previous life, depending upon one's karma, depending upon causeless mercy, which one may receive. Education in itself can also produce dry scholarship. People who are very learned, but don't necessarily have a heart. It can also be. You can have great scholars, very learned, very wise, with no heart. I see education as very important, but as subordinate to pure devotional service, as supporting. It's very important, but it is a support. Education itself will not necessarily move the heart. There's something there which, as I mentioned, is to me mystical and can either happen because of previous lives. Some people search. I mean, Bhagavad Gita speaks about that, about four people who comes to a devotional service for various reasons. And the Gita says that the Gyani, he who search for knowledge, is the highest. But I think it's a mystical question, really, which each soul and that their position, previous karma, personal quest, and of course causeless mercy. And we as devotees, we distribute mercy. That's the main thing we do. We distribute everything. Harinam, we distribute books, we distribute prasadam, we have a temple so everyone can come. That's basically, I would say, our service, our part in all that is to distribute the mercy. And Ashila Prabhupada says the rain falls everywhere. Sometimes the rain causes fructification, and other times it may just fall on the sea or barren land and nothing happens. So, yeah, that's what I say.
Thank you,
Prabhupada. Yes, Prabhu? Yes, ladies. They occur. Yeah, I agree. I try to make this connection that our practice is a type of yogic practice. Yeah. This is our bhakti yoga. This is our tapasya. I agree. Mataji, is anything? Did I miss there? It's a question? No. Yes, please. You need a loudspeaker. Last question and we'll wind up, I think. Yeah, it is very... the question is it important to do yoga in the morning? And the answer is yes, it's very important. Our yoga is chanting. This is our yoga practice. We do it in a regulated way. That we do that in doing chanting. It has various aspects. One aspect is the personal encounter with Krishna. That we have Krishna dancing in our tongue and we surrender to Krishna. But chanting also has a yogic component. It is regulated. It requires mental control to bring the mind back to the japa. So, yes, Mangala Arati is also yoga. So we should do yoga in the morning, but our devotional yoga, Mangala Arati, regulated, chanting, even this is yoga. So yes, but devotional yoga, bhakti yoga, that's the answer. Hare Krishna, thank you very much. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Hare Bol.